Welcome to The Road Untraveled. I'm your host, Brian Hollins, and today we have a special guest in Sheel Tile, founder and CEO of Amplo, a global VC firm focused on building companies that matter. Sheel was previously co-head of the seed practice at NEA and is a board member of Andela, recently named the number one most innovative company in Africa. Sheel graduated from Stanford at just 19 years old and holds a JD from Harvard Law School. After starting his own fund at such a young age, Sheel has really built a close ear to the ground on innovative companies that are being started by young teams, with examples like Robinhood, One Concern, Mark 43, and many more. Today, Sheel and I discuss the impact of false rallies in the stock market, his principle and this notion of building companies that matter, and the perseverance of a downturn founder that leads to great companies being built out of recessions. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for joining The Road Untraveled.
Hey, Sheel, how's it going?
Great. How are you?
You know, I'm as good as I can be, but I'm very excited to chat with you. Hope you and your family are doing well.
Yeah, it's great to connect with you again.
Absolutely. You know, for anyone just joining us, Sheel's a partner at Amplo, and I'm very excited for him to give a little bit of background, both on the fund and his kind of experience in venture. Sheel, maybe just to start from the top, give us a sense of what Amplo is up to today. And the things that are sort of top of mind for you in the portfolio.
Yeah, so I started Amplo in 2017, and the goal was to invest in companies that matter. We like to call it building companies that matter. Our belief is the biggest companies in the world are created by entrepreneurs who aren't motivated by money. Instead, they're motivated by solving a real problem. And we think if that's your mindset, that's how you create something that gets through really hard times like we're facing now. It's how you create something that allows you to be able to recruit people in a tough job market. And it also allows you to build something with really big enterprise value. So we're on our second fund now, and we've been pretty slow to deploy capital, largely because over the last 2 years, we felt like valuations were a little out of whack. And I think that time diversity of investing is something that I learned actually at my time at Bessemer Venture Partners, where I started my venture career. And as a result, I think over the next year or two or however long the coronavirus crisis lasts, as well as its fallout, I think having capital to invest could be really interesting.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about those valuations being out of whack. I think it'd actually be interesting to spend a little time on public capital markets. I mean, the S&P 100 is sitting above 2,800 in a time where, you know, I think we've crossed 20 million plus, you know, unemployed. Just give me your thoughts on public markets and kind of the run up that we're seeing.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, So we have, let's set the stage. We have unemployment at an all time high, as you mentioned, or at least at the highest rate, probably in our professional careers. We have the Federal Reserve printing money. We have governments around the world issuing massive amounts of debt. We have most companies, not all companies, but the vast majority of companies going to miss and probably miss dramatically their Q2 and probably Q3.
Yep.
And yet the stock market's ripping. And so the natural question is why? And here's what I make of it. Interest rates are at an all-time low. At least in the US. To me, it's the public markets ripping is largely a function of a few things. One, there's nowhere else to put your money if you are lucky enough to be investing in the stock market. And it's worth noting that the majority of Americans do not have exposure to the stock market. So the stock market ripping has, in my opinion, almost nothing to do with the actual fundamentals of what an everyday American is feeling. And so governments that, especially our government, that looks toward the stock market seemingly as a semblance of economic health are wrong. You know, they're just not, it's just not the same thing. But anyway, the first thing is, in my opinion, really low interest rates. And if you are trying to make money today, where else are you going to be able to put it, right? I mean, there's sort of, you can't put it in bonds. You don't really want debt. So where would you put it? So I think that one of the main drivers is really low interest rates. I think the second driver is trading volume has massively increased. And, you know, I think a lot of this does lead to volatility, but mostly upward volatility. You know, I think, I think over time with massive amounts of trading volume increase, usually that means stock prices go up over time, since on average, there's slightly more long buyers than there are short sellers. But I also think that this could be temporary. If you look at the last five recessions, there have been many what I like to call false rallies in the ultimate plunge downwards. And so if you were to actually overlay the charts from 2008 or 2000 or many of the crises before that, what you would see is over a year's period of time, a downward trajectory. But within that year, there were multiple times where the stock market actually rallied 5, 10, 15%. And we could be in the midst or perhaps at the tail end of one of those really significant false rallies. Maybe I'll stop there.
No, it's really well said. And, you know, I think to your point, public markets in some ways are reacting to maybe inconsistent measures, if you will, around the health of the economy. Let's switch a little bit to the private markets. And I think you can make the same argument, right? That private valuations, private multiples will oftentimes lag public. And so what are your thoughts and perspectives on, you know, the changing sort of multiples that private investors are going to be paying for SaaS companies over the next 12 months?
Yeah. What's funny is SaaS companies in the public markets have held up extremely well. And many SaaS companies are at all-time highs. Right. If we look at the Zooms of the world, they're obviously benefiting from this. But even companies like Datadog or CrowdStrike or some of the other top tier SaaS companies that have gone public in the last 12 or 24 months, they are either close to all time highs or at their 52 week price, their 52 week high.
Yeah.
So to me, what that suggests is private market investors at the late stage and really solid enterprise software companies or SaaS businesses will look to those private market, those public market valuations and think, well, gee, if CrowdStrike is trading at 20 or 30 times forward revenue, I think I'm going to have to pay 20 to 30 times forward revenue. And so I haven't really seen valuations fall yet. There was a period of time towards the end of March where the stock market was dropping every day 8%. Where I did see valuations fall across the board and really deals were just not getting done. Everybody was sort of holding on, but you know, we're now at the end of April and deals are getting done again. And they are getting done at, in my opinion, crazy prices. It's sort of the same prices that they were getting done at pre-coronavirus. And I'm particularly talking about the late stage. You know, I think the early stage is actually a little bit different. I think the early stage, for whatever reason, activity is completely slowed down. And I think that's largely because everybody is a little bit more nervous at the early stage. And I think they're worried that the later stage investors are going to get cold feet. And as a result, they feel like they are going to have additional capital to be able to support their companies. So I think folks, my peers, want to make fewer bets since they think they're going to have to carry the water.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Amplo portfolio. You know, as you think about the triaging and the types of conversations you're having, what are some of the best practices and things that you're sharing with your companies around kind of how to maintain, some sense of communication and consistency with their employees through times like this when everyone's, you know, digital?
It's a great question. I would say the first piece of feedback that I have given, but I've also heard from a number of other terrific CEOs as well as venture capitalists, is hope for the best, plan for the worst. And I think that is the route that a number of our companies are taking, where there are sort of three financial plans that everybody is operating under. Plan one is the return to normalcy soon plan, which is the bull case plan. Plan two is the base case plan, which is the things don't go back to normal for a while. And then there is the plan C plan, which is the sort of the worst case plan, which is we're in a shutdown for 18 months and revenue churns dramatically, assume very few new customers and maybe no new customers and loss of existing customers. How long can you stay afloat? And so the general piece of advice that we're giving is, in a world where things get worse and we are in the midst of a false rally, do you have enough cash to last you 24 to 30 months? Are you able to not have to fundraise in 2021 and therefore be alive and be kicking in 2022? So that's sort of the first thing. And the second thing is, as it relates to communication, be transparent with employees. I think a couple of our companies have done a good job where, even though these companies are actually doing well and haven't been as impacted for whatever reason by coronavirus and are still choosing to lay off folks because of the plan for the worst scenario, they are over-communicating with employees. And, you know, I think what that looks like is just really sharing the rationale and not just saying, we're in the middle of a crisis, you're terminated, but instead saying, look, we're in the middle of a crisis. Here's what's going on with our business. Here are the customers we're gaining. Here are the customers we're losing. Here's what's going on with the financing market. You've been an amazing part of the company. You know, the board decided that we have to plan for the worst. We hope you understand. Severance package. Just treating the employees like partners as opposed to treating them like commodities, right? And what, you know, one of our companies, when that conversation happened with an employee actually, you know, the response was, we totally get it. In fact, I would do the exact same. I'm the biggest champion of the company. How can I exercise my options today? And to me, that's like the biggest vote of confidence that an employee can have, where they choose to exercise their options immediately upon having to leave the company.
Yeah. No, sharing the rationale. I've actually never heard that. I think that's really well said. And a great way to think about how founders can sort of bring their employees along for the ride a little bit. I think a lot of people sort of feel left out in the open and sort of gripped with uncertainty right now. And so helping them understand the decision-making process, I think is super interesting.
Yeah.
Let's spend a little bit of time on the fundraising side, because I know, you know, you as you mentioned, you're on fund two, but even fund one, if you look back to 2017, I mean, it's not easy to raise a fund. And so as you think about someone that's raising maybe their first fund or happened to be out on the market during the midst of this with just, you know, bad timing, what is your advice as they think about finding the right GPs in the midst of so much uncertainty?
It's a great question. So, okay, so I would say a couple of things from a GP perspective, and then I'll say from an LP perspective. So from a GP perspective, I actually have a few friends who are fundraising right now. In fact, I was on the phone with two of them yesterday, talking them through what I would do if I were them. And I think the general piece of advice is just get in business, right? A lot of people have certain fund targets, and commitments today are either taking longer or non-existent. I think everybody wants, I think it's quite obvious, folks want liquidity, right? And liquidity, there's a liquidity premium right now, which, by the way, could be another reason why the stock market's ripping, because you have that liquidity premium. And as a result, commitments are just taking longer or they're not happening at all. So what I've told my friends who are raising funds today is get in business. Don't worry about your target. Don't worry about the number. Just get in business. Many great funds have started far smaller than you think. You know, David Einhorn's fund, Greenlight, started with less than $1 million. Thrive, I think Thrive's first fund was, what, $10 million? And so a lot of these top-tier funds started with far less capital than you would think. And so I think advice number one is just get in business. Advice number two is, pick LPs that are long-term greedy, long-term focused, but don't do it at the extent of the economics of your own business. You know, I've had some of my GP friends be approached with offers of folks who essentially want to seed the fund and take a pretty meaningful portion of the management company. And my advice to them is, do that if it accelerates your fundraising significantly and if that person brings strategic value. But otherwise, don't sacrifice your long-term interests in the fund for short-term gain, right? I'd rather you take it slower, raise less money, or take longer to raise money, but own all of your business than give up a meaningful portion of your business in perpetuity and have to deal with the ramifications down the line. So that's sort of advice number two. And then advice number three is the people who are usually going to write your first checks are people who you know, especially in this time where in-person meetings are near impossible. And so it doesn't make a ton of sense if you're a first-time manager or even a second-time manager to start pitching, you know, new endowment.
New people.
Yeah. Focus on the people who you know. And sure, they may write smaller checks because they're more likely to be individuals and rather than institutions, but that's okay.
Yeah. That's great. What's keeping you up at night? I'm curious, you know, as you think about just being in this ecosystem, if this is, you know, if this is a false rally, if we are headed to, you know, kind of 12 months of a little bit of tough times, you know, regardless of what you're selling, what's sort of keeping you concerned right now?
So I would say what's keeping me concerned. So I think making sure that I would say the things keeping me concerned. Hold on, I'm going to start this answer again.
Yep.
Let me think about this one. I would say there are two things keeping me concerned. One has to do with the world, and the second has to do with the startup ecosystem. As it relates to the world, the thing I'm most concerned about is the mass amounts of money being printed that don't seem to be very efficient. I think that causes two things. One is over time, inflation, right? Right now, doesn't really cause that because everybody's doing it in some way, and the demand shock is greater than the supply shock, but at some point that could turn. And the other reason I'm a little worried about that is it's pretty inefficient. I feel like if the ultimate goal is to get capital in the hands of people, the way that it's currently been done via businesses or payroll guarantees or this and that are arguably the least efficient way to do it. And so that worries me. I think long-term structurally, it doesn't set a good precedent, and it doesn't keep the value or faith of the general public in either their government or their currency. So that's sort of one thing that worries me at a macro level. At a micro level, I would say as it relates to my startups or the startups that we are viewing, I think it's just going to be harder. I mean, the bar is higher for a startup to make a sale today. You know, people to part with money, it's just harder. And so I think the winners in this ecosystem will keep winning. And it's just going to be that much harder to start a company. The flip side, though, is, and many folks have touted this, downturns are when the best companies get created. And I think that's largely because of the perseverance that is required to create a company during a downturn, right? If you are taking a risk during a downturn, beating down doors figuratively in a world where nobody wants to meet you face to face, and still able to get customer sales, then you're somebody special. And I think that's why. I think it's largely as a function of who survives in this market, Darwinian principles, versus anything special about a downturn, which is what leads to great companies being created.
Certainly a good crop to be a part of if you're a part of that kind of 08, 09 vintage. And I guess to be determined on whether that's true for the 2021 vintage. But I certainly agree with you that, you know, it takes a different kind of founder and a different type of grit to be trying to build and still believing in your product and vision right now versus, you know, a 2018 founder that, you know, got something on paper and it was able to raise a couple million bucks.
Exactly.
So, we'll see. Last one for you, Shiel. This has been super fun. I appreciate you being here. I'm curious, you know, if there are any industries that you're watching in particular, things that you're excited about, you know, whether it's, you know, for the next 6 months while we're really just jumping online, or if there's, you know, longer term, you know, things that will occur as a result of this change that you're excited to potentially invest in.
Well, I think the thing I'm most the thing I'm most surprised by and excited by right now is actually, I would say, the millennial generation's engagement with the financial markets. And I have seen that largely through our company Robinhood, but I've also seen that through, as we look at other fintech type companies, the engagement has been through the roof. And arguably it's because there's nothing else for people to do right now, right? That all they can do is watch Netflix.
Then buy options on Robinhood.
Yeah, go to TikTok or Robinhood. But I mean, you know, was the biggest growth month in Robinhood's history by an order of magnitude, multiples bigger than the previous all-time high month, which was February. And April looks amazing too. And so it's just largely, I think people are starting to understand that this is really important. The world is changing. They have a lot of free time on their hands. And so people are learning about the stock market. And I have gotten pinged from friends, from cousins. I'm the oldest on both sides of my mom's side, my dad's side. And, you know, my 10th grade cousin is pinging me every morning as soon as he wakes up, being like, Inovio, all is skyrocketing, rocket ship, or oops, I sold Gilead. Did you see that the drug the north? I mean, this, you know, like, these are 10th graders, 11th graders, as college kids, and they're really excited about the stock market right now. And to me, that's a great sign of building wealth long term. I think the earlier you start, the better. I started in college. I made a lot of mistakes, and I'm glad I made the mistakes then, because even though they felt like
smaller
honestly,
pool
it felt
of
like
money.
A lot of money back then. But in retrospect, they were cheap mistakes, right. And I'm really happy I made them. Right. And so, yeah, that's a trend I'm most excited by, and I think we're going to see that reverberate in companies where there are various digital financial products to be played with or to learn from.
Yeah, I think that's great. Shield Tile from Amplo, thank you so much for being here, man. It was really good.
Really
to catch
good
up.
To speak to you, Brian, and thanks for doing this.
Of course, of course. Have a good weekend and stay safe,
right,
stay healthy.
Care. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.